Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby.
Hello and welcome to Movies vs. Capitalism, an anti-capitalist movie podcast. I am Frank Capello.
And I'm Rivka Rivera.
And we are recording this a little bit ahead of time. We're recording this on Friday, March 22nd, because Rivka and I will both be traveling this weekend for the AMBY Awards. So anything we're talking about today might have changed by the time this you're hearing this episode by next week, but I know there's one thing I wanted to talk about that kind of I feel like everyone is talking about right now, which is this this documentary series. I haven't seen it, but you have.
Quiet on Set. Have you seen clips on TikTok? I feel like this is one of those that I saw almost the whole thing on TikTok before I sat down and watched this four-part series. So this documentary is Quiet on Set, The Dark Side of Kids TV. It's a four-part docu-series directed by Mary Robertson and Emma Schwartz, and it gets deep. It gets deep into Nickelodeon and kids TV of the 90s, which Nickelodeon was really the reigning company on. I mean, were you a big Nick person? I mean, how could you not be?
I was mainlining Nickelodeon into my veins every single day as a child. Yeah. From like the animated stuff to the live action stuff, the sitcom stuff. Yeah, I was a Nick kid for sure.
Actually, as I asked you that question, I realized that it is, you know, even before we dive into that, the answer to that question, because I was like, oh, are you a Nick kid? But it was Nickelodeon was such a like defining class factor, because I remember when I had it and I remember what I did, because it's a cable thing and cable, like now streaming, everybody has pretty much, not everybody, but it's a lot more accessible, where like, I feel like the cable thing was a huge dividing factor. And I remember the periods of time when my family didn't have it, and then the periods of time when my family did, and how badly I wanted to have it, and how bad it felt the moments when we didn't have it.
Wow. Yeah.
How then there were periods of time where, like, my mom, we would have it at my mom's house, but then I would go to my dad's and we didn't have it unless we were stealing the cable. Like, that was a whole thing.
Yeah, the illegal cable boxes.
The illegal cable boxes. I'd be trying to watch Nick. I'd be getting, like, the porn channel. It was a whole thing. Like, shout out to stealing cable. But yeah, and then I remember I was talking to Tommy about this, and he's like, yeah, well, there was a whole period of time that he missed when we were watching Quiet on Set. He's like, well, I didn't have cable during that period of time. So you would be really separated from certain like cultural things and all that was like, I loved all that. And I remember like anytime I could get to a friend's house to watch Nick when we didn't have cable, and then we did, being like glued to it. So yes, Nickelodeon, a defining factor for kids of the 90s, and there was some competition with the Disney Channel, and the show gets into a little bit about like that competition, but really it was like this wild time for kids TV. It was a boom, and this documentary series gets into, as they say, the dark side. So it gets into the culture on set, particularly with like the main guy, Dan Schneider, who created all of these shows, starting with All That, which was like a kid's SNL. That's how it was pitched, into sort of, as he says, discovers Amanda Bynes and then creates The Amanda Show, which I loved. And I haven't finished the series yet, but it really is doing an amazing job, a terrifying job of showing not only the levels of exploitation that happened to these kids, but also to everybody who is working on this set, and how essentially you can get away with pretty much fucking anything if someone's making a profit, and that nobody questioned what was going on these sets. There had been early on his first show, one of the most striking stories was these two female writers on an all-male show writing for The Amanda Show. They were forced to share a contract, so they were getting paid each half a salary, and they do a really good job of outlining, you know, why they had to say yes to it, because it's so rare to get a job like that. They came to Hollywood hustling for this. They were offered this. It's like, what are they going to turn it down? They don't want to they want to leave their temp job. So at least it was like the bare minimum. And then they just go on to talk about, like, you already have someone under those exploitative circumstances because of the context of the system as it is. and they just had to deal with so much sexism, so many what a disgusting, horrible man, the way he ran the set. And this was, again, early on in his reign. He goes on to work for, it's like 20 years of shows he's created. One gets fired for taking like two or three personal days. They're overworked. The other is asked to come back, but basically asked to work for 11 months for free. And she's like, fuck this.
Oh my God.
She leaves, sues him, hoping that this lawsuit would lead to like this level of exploitation stopping. It doesn't. They just kind of throw it under the rug. And, this happens time and time again. And I think what's important is just like documentaries like this show us how this system creates the plague. If it wasn't Dan Schneider, it could be another person who, as long as they're bringing in like all of this surplus capital to the company, you can do whatever. You need to hire a bunch of pedophiles for your set. Fine. Scream at all these children and send them into like years and years of trauma. Fine. Whatever you need to do, because you're making so much money for us. And then it's interesting. I'll end on this. I haven't finished the series, and I know there's so much there, and we could probably cover this in like a premium episode, but he has come out now and he's kind of doing an apology, a little bit of an apology tour, but he did like his official apology interview kind of thing to
be accountable. Some headlines about that, yeah,
for the behavior, which I think it's important to be accountable. I think real accountability. I haven't really listened to the full thing. I don't know if that's this or if this is, my immediate assumption is it's bullshit, like covering someone, your ass, a little too late. But one thing that struck me was he does talk about a lot of this behavior he blames. Again, I don't know if it's blaming, but it is originates from being having to produce so many shows, like this, as Marx would call it, the cyclopean machine of just like needing, being the lead producer and having to output so much stuff, and that he bought into that being like the stress of that, and the need to just be more and more and more productive and create more and more shows, mm-hmm. led him on the cycle to be an abusive fucking asshole, which I don't think is an excuse, but I also think like, yeah, these circumstances and these systems put people in these roles to be absolute assholes because you just need to get more and more value and give less and less a fuck about people. Like, it doesn't work for the profit margin to treat people well if you want like a ridiculous amount of wealth.
Yeah, it also seems like the other, you know, just like big part of this story is that, you know, these were child actors, and, you know, children just have so much less agency than adults. And, you know, historically, I don't want to generalize too much, but historically, stage parents aren't necessarily the most protective kind of parents. You know, there's a reason that they've put their children in this position to begin with. You know, and sometimes it might be like the kid saying like, oh, I really want to do this. And sometimes it might be the parent saying, hey, you're our new cash cow. We were talking about this recently, I forget, on some interview about how child labor is illegal. I guess child labor is coming back these days, but like generally,
I think
people,
it's the one that we're actually going to be talking about today.
Yeah, just like how child labor, we accept that it should not exist. Children should not have to do labor except for acting. It's like the only loophole, and it's fucked up. And I don't know what the correct answer is for the child actor question.
It's interesting what you were saying about the kids having the responsibility oftentimes to be the breadwinners for their family. So mm-hmm. again, there's like the outside system that then you see this opportunity like Hollywood where like maybe you can, there's one kid, maybe you can help your family out tremendously. There's one of the kids, I can't remember the, now he's an adult, but the man's name, a black man who was on All That and talks, it was one of the most moving interviews. This is why I do think it's a really good documentary series, but he's talking about how he felt like it was he was going to get his family like out of their neighborhood, out of the hood, and all that economic responsibility on him meant that like, yeah, he felt so much pressure to allow whatever. He immediately was like, there's a lot of racist shit happening on this set, but I have to let it happen. And his mom talks about feeling the same way because the potential loss of this job is tremendous. Yeah. And it's the same for a lot of those kids. And they intentionally, I think that's the other part about like child actors is oftentimes you're like, well, who is being taken out of school to maybe get one of these jobs to go to work is probably kids from like economic circumstances where it's like something they really need. And that is completely exploited. And that's what this this series does a really great job of showing. I mean, it's a horrendous, horrendous story, but really brave on these filmmakers, really brave for these actors to be speaking out, because this freaking director has, I mean, all these people, you also see like how much power they have. There's a pedophile who's like a child acting coach who gets arrested and goes to jail, not for nearly enough time, who all of these people in Hollywood, including, I hate to break it to you, Frank, but James Marsden, writing a letter of support for this man, but then they put him right back to work. And it's like, why? It's not only because they like these people, it just, it works more for capital than it does for these children. And this, they want to keep the system moving. And that is the most upsetting freaking shit. And we give, you know, we go off on like, oh, these crazy right wingers who think these crazy conspiracy theories. You're like, well, you see where they freaking get it from. It's not a conspiracy. Like, this shit is happening. It's just not to feed the blood of children to keep you young. It's just to keep capital moving. Like, again, it's one of those things where you're like, you're not far. You're just, that whole satanic child's blood thing is a little off course.
Yeah. Naomi Klein puts it really well, where she's like, conspiracy theorists are getting like the feelings right, but the analysis wrong. It's like, I feel that there is something, that there is some organized effort to, you know, keep me from having affordable housing, healthcare, whatever. But the actual analysis is, it's not the shadowy cabal of like hidden Illuminati people who are pulling the strings. It is the very obvious and forward-facing capitalist class who do all of their like bribery and corruption out in the open. You know, it's just like, we're lobbying Congress to keep you from having these things. It's not a conspiracy. It's just the system.
There it is. Once again, I was like, I'll touch on this. Here we are. It's deep. And I haven't even finished the series. Look at me go.
I remember we talked a little bit about this on our Good Burger episode, because Good Burger, another Dan Schneider creation. And I remember we talked a little about him with our guest Andrew T. And this was like almost a year ago at this point. But yeah, I should check it out. As a former Nick kid and someone who, you know, cares about things like this, I'll do the due diligence.
Be prepared. It will. I was happy that I prepared myself, because it's very triggering. There's a lot of traumatic stuff.
All right, well, let's get to our conversation today about, God, one of the maybe best movies ever, The Truman Show. But before we do, we just want to remind our audience that we do not sell ads on this show. We rely completely on community support to keep the show going.
If you'd like to support us, you can do that by subscribing to our Patreon account. For just $5 a month, you get access to new bonus episodes and our back catalog of bonus episodes. You can find our Patreon link in the episode description in your podcast player, or by going to mvcpod.com.
Also, please make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast on your podcast player so you don't miss any of our new episodes. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to get to our interview. Just a heads up, our guest, Jaffer Khan, wonderful, hilarious guy. Unfortunately, his microphone stopped working about halfway through the interview. So you might notice a little bit of like an audio quality change. It's nothing drastic, but I just wanted to point that out. But we will be right back with the aforementioned Jaffer Khan and our conversation about The Truman Show.
Hey, everyone. We know that the humanitarian crisis in Gaza is at the forefront of everyone's minds right now. So we wanted to take a moment and share some resources with our listeners on how you can help.
You can go to ceasefiretoday.com, which has a list of resources for actions to demand a ceasefire from our Congress people. You can send them mass emails. You can sign a petition. You can find a protest. You can phone bank. They have a call script that will allow you to easily call all of your Congress people. Again, that is ceasefiretoday.com.
And remember, the only way forward is addressing the root causes of violence, Israeli military occupation, and apartheid, and ending U.S. complicity in this oppression.
I know it feels like this crisis is really insurmountable right now, but the more we call our Congress people, the more we show up at marches, the more we do anything and everything, will help. So keep at it. If we all do this together, we can actually move the needle. Love you all. Solidarity. And stay safe.
So today we have a wonderful guest, Jaffer Khan, who is a stand-up comedian and TV writer based out of New York, a former correspondent on Redacted Tonight, and currently a contributor for Mondo Weiss. Welcome, Jaffer.
Thank you, Rivka, Frank, both of y'all. Thanks for having me. Very happy to be here.
Very happy for you to be joining us. So a little bit of background for the audience. Jaffer, I came across, I think, your stand-up comedy, your political commentary, I believe, on TikTok for the first time. And I remember the first time I saw some of your stuff, I was, one, laughing my ass off. I think you're extremely funny. And two...
Thanks, man.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for the lols. But secondly, you do a lot of political comedy that is very sharp, that is, like, very incisive, that I think would, that I think pushes the boundaries of what I think most respectable liberals would accept in their sort of, like, you know, Jon Stewart brand of political comedy. I think you really, you kind of, like, take a jump over that, and you're like, no, but I'm going to go to the real heart of the fucking problem, and we're going to get deep on it, but I'm also going to remain funny. So... I would just love to hear a little bit more about your background and how you got into doing this work.
Thanks, man. Yeah, they call me the 9/11 guy. That's kind of the first bit. First time I got on TikTok, and like that was the video that really did that did really well. But yeah, I started in Houston, and that was kind of like the running joke with my comedy friends in Texas was how much I liked to talk about. You know, obviously, you know, I'm talking about, like, Islamophobia and, like, imperialism and stuff. But, you know, 9/11 guy is just kind of a funny way to put it. So that's kind of what stuck. It's fun.
Yeah, because there's really only one other 9/11 guy. And he's the one that we all know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to take his throne. And I'm sure he would like to give me... I'm sure he would like to give up that throne. You're talking about... wait, no, there's two 9/11 guys. I don't know which one you're talking about. Are you talking about Pete
Davidson? I'm talking about Osama bin Laden.
Oh, my God. Okay. Yes. All right. So there's four 9/11 guys. I was thinking about Pete Davidson, right? His dad lost his dad 9/11. Then there was, what's his name? You know what I'm talking about? Steve Brzezinski. Do you know who I'm talking about? He did, he famously lied.
From The League, that comedian from that TV show. Yeah. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. He, famously lied about being like at the World Trade Center.
Wow.
Then there's me who talks about 9/11, and then there's Osama bin Laden. Yeah,
the four of you are the 9/11 guys.
Yeah. The thing I've been doing longest is stand up that brought me to New York, and it's been like up and down. You know, I've done a little bit of TV writing, CBS, Comedy Central, but Redacted Tonight was my favorite. That really allowed me to, you know, as a stand-up, you can talk about this sort of stuff, but the medium of stand-up is restricting. I guess I should say the restriction of stand-up is that you really have to be laugh out loud funny constantly, you know. So that is kind of a restriction, but on Redacted, I got to, I got to play a journalist. So, you know, I could talk about stuff a little bit more. And so Redacted, I don't know if you know about Redacted Tonight, but it was on RT America, Russian Television America, and it got canceled very suddenly when, you know, my boss, Vladimir Putin, invaded Ukraine. And then the whole channel got taken off the air, moved back to New York. And it was after Redacted, I got on TikTok and started like kind of doing more Redacted kind of stuff and posting my stand up. So I think most people who know me probably know me from like TikTok and Instagram, like doing reels since the last 2 years. I've been doing that since Redacted went off the air. So that's me. I'm back to being like a broke comic in Brooklyn in the trenches trying to survive, which is nice. I enjoy that. I was in D.C. for Redacted Tonight. I really hated D.C. So it's good to be back in New York. And y'all, Frank, you're in New York, right?
Yes. Rivka and I are both in New York. I grew up in Jersey. Rivka is like a born and bred Brooklynite.
And I would arguably say I'm the most from here because...
For sure.
I don't know if we consider Jersey, New York.
Some people in New Jersey definitely do. Some people in Paramus, New Jersey, when they are asked, where are you from? They're like, I'm from New York City.
Yeah, I don't know. I just watched The Sopranos for the first time.
Wow.
Oh, hell yeah.
I'm a fan of New Jersey now because I finally watched The Sopranos. And so that's New Jersey culture. That's all I know so far.
That show has done more goodwill for New Jersey and Italian Americans than I think any piece of media has done for any culture or ethnicity in history writ large. I'm like, I want to turn this into a Sopranos.
I know. I think we all had that pot. We all had that moment together where we're like, we're not here to talk about the Sopranos. We gotta stay focused.
But it would be actually a good topic to talk about on this podcast. But maybe we'll do that in the future. But today we are talking about a film that you chose for us to watch, which I was very excited because I had not seen it since pretty much its release. You chose The Truman Show.
Yes.
Directed by Peter Weir, written by Andrew Niccol, starring Jim Carrey, Laura Linney, Ed Harris, Noah Emmerich, and Natasha McElhone. The budget was $60 million, grossed $264 million worldwide.
Nice.
Pretty good hit. And a little synopsis of this film tells the story of 29-year-old Truman Burbank, an affable small-town guy who lives in the picturesque American town Sea Haven Island. But Truman begins to discover the truth that his entire life has been a manufactured TV series in which he is the star. Truman's world begins to unravel as he seeks to learn the truth and ultimately escape from the prison of his fabricated reality.
And some historical context before we dive in. This film was released on June 5th, 1998. Other movies that we've covered on this podcast from this year are You've Got Mail and Ants. Wow. Wow. That's
what
one
year.
Of those pauses. I didn't realize it. Yeah, what a year. It's near the end of the Clinton era. So this is the year of Monica Lewinsky and the Monica Lewinsky scandal. This is also the height of the dot-com bubble. We're talking AOL, AIM, Netscape Navigator. Oh, Netscape Navigator.
Oof.
Google was founded this year, and the first MP3 player was also released in Japan this year. The average cost of a new home in 1998 is $182,000. Wow. Medium income is $38,500. And a gallon of gas is $1.06.
Damn.
Before we jump into our movie convo, do you remember what you were doing in the year 1998?
I was in third grade, I believe. I was having a great time in America. I was like, this is never going to stop. I'm never going to get old, and the economy is never going to go back down, and I'm never going to learn about the things we're doing overseas. I was a happy kid, and I saw, first I want to say, like, when I was looking up some stuff earlier today for this, I learned that this movie, so Truman Show came out in 98, Big Brother, the first real, like, mm-hmm. what we consider reality show in UK, came out in 99. So I assumed that Truman Show, now that we're like, you know, years past, was supposed to be like a satire of like the early stages of reality television, but it wasn't. It was actually more prophetic because it came out before reality television, just a year before.
Well, there was The Real World, which aired first in 92.
Yes.
But it hadn't probably leaped.
Well, never mind.
It didn't.
Delete what I said.
No, it was on the cusp of the reality boom for sure. Because then
boom,
you're right.
Yeah.
It's like Big Brother, Survivor, Amazing Race, like all come out within a spate of like 2 years or so.
Yeah.
Right after this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely prophetic. And I think probably the screenplay was being written before or around the same time.
Yeah. So we could say at least prophetic of like the craze.
And then there was also EdTV, which came out, I think, the year after, which was sort of like the other reality TV. That was like have you ever seen that movie, Matthew McConaughey? That was like, that one's basically like, hey, reality TV is about to become this thing. We're going to pay this guy Ed to make his life reality TV 24/7. So it's like kind of Truman Show, but if Truman actually knew that he was in the show.
With Dennis Hopper, who was supposed to be the original Christoph.
Ooh.
Oh, interesting.
So Jaffa, the first thing we start the conversation with, we ask our guest, why did you choose this movie to talk about on this podcast? And yeah, you started getting into it a little bit about its prophetic nature, but yeah, what's your relationship with Truman Show?
I'm happy I chose this movie. It wasn't really, you know, the way you explained the premise to me of the podcast, you really were like, you know, you could really watch whatever, anything, which I agree with. You could really make anything about capitalism, so it doesn't have to be explicitly about it. And then on the list, I was just like, oh man, Truman Show, like I haven't seen that since it came out. Obviously it would be a great movie to talk about in this context. And I wanted to go back because it's true. I had only seen it in theaters when it came out and not once since then. And when it came out, it really frightened me. It really scared me because, so I looked it up. I forgot the term for it, but like there's this term for the belief or the philosophy that you're the only real person. And that could mean a lot of different things. Like it could mean like a philosophy of like, that's the only thing you could truly know, like kind of like a Descartes thing, or it could mean like sort of a delusion. When I was a young kid, I remember having this intense feeling of like trying to imagine that, like, okay, I'm like this person with a consciousness and feelings and a whole life. And when I would try to wrap my head around the fact that everyone else also has this,
yeah,
it became overwhelming to me. And it would frighten me. And I started to wonder, I started to like not believe it. I was like, there's no way. There's no way there could be that much going on. Maybe it's just me. And then so we went and saw Truman Show and it really scared me.
Damn, those are some existential thoughts for a third grader.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think just when you're a kid, you have all these crazy fears. And so when you try to like explain them as an adult, it sounds like philosophical. But I think like a lot of our weird fears we had as children could be like kind of, you could find some philosopher who kind of like wrote like a book about it, you know?
Sure.
I mean, it's totally logical. I don't think it's that weird. If you take any pause to consider our existence on this planet, I think you'll get to where you were thinking. I mean, that's my like evening ritual. It's like go to bed, think about the existential dread.
Yes, it is kind of also like an empathy kind of exercise, I guess. But yeah, so I wanted to watch it again, and I was kind of blown away how good the movie is. It really
so good.
It really held up.
Yeah,
from beginning to end, it's very unique movie structurally. I love it's. It's very much about capital. Like the very first scene is an ad, and I loved all the ads they were playing throughout the movie, and it's extremely prophetic because now we're in this age of like social media and TikTok, and reality is content and content is reality, and reality and content therefore are all monetized. So everything is also an ad, and
yeah,
it's very like dystopian. So like all those like very funny scenes in Truman Show where he's like having a conversation with someone and they like turn and like do the ad to like some hidden camera. I feel like we are seeing this all the time with all these like crazy TikToks that go viral, and then you find out like, oh, that was actually not real. That was like completely manufactured by this company who like is there to like create influencers, and that's why they had this product in there. And you know, you thought you were having like a moment and escaping your day, but really like no, you were being sold like Fritos or something. And Truman Show really captures that in a you know, in their funny way.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I agree. I thought there was something so interesting about when I first saw it, thinking, oh, it's so prophetic of reality television. And this time through, I was just like, oh, this is all about TikTok. This is all about the self-surveillance reality that we're living in now under capitalism. At its core, I think the reason it still says so much about where we're at is because it's really a film about how we've just been conditioned to accept the realities of capitalism, no matter how far they take us. And there's that line that Christoph gives that I think is pretty, like, it's the big line associated with this film. We accept the reality of the world with which we are presented. And that's the premise that Ed Harris sort of gives us very, like, brilliantly, playing this maniacal director king capitalist about the film. But it's about this man Truman whose entire life has been commodified and how a whole world has been taught to accept the conditions of his commodification and thus the conditions of our own. And just to get the audience into it, if you haven't seen this movie in a while, Truman was literally, he's the first human to be adopted by a corporation.
Incredible stuff.
Incredible. And you know, under any other system or culture or world, like you know you could be looking at this through a different lens, and the culture and society would be like, this is imprisonment, this is horrific. And of course there's only like a small resistance, that is recognizing this for like the authoritarian horrific nature that it is, like stealing all of Truman's freedoms. But the addiction is made so clear that the audience, like the whole world, has grown up with Truman. So in some ways you see this, like the role of the audience's addiction and unwillingness to let go of a Truman character because they've been taught to need that as part of their worldview. It's very capitalist realism in the sense that there's no way of imagining a world without Truman.
Yeah.
And so it's pretty brilliant watching the arc of like Truman actually breaking that reality for this audience and seeing their reactions to it as well. There's so much in this movie. I'm so excited you chose this for us.
Yeah, I like you brought up the audience and they're like a willing participant. And I loved in the movie, they showed that like not all of the society was into it. There was, they showed like the Free Truman movement, you know, the people who wanted to get rid of the show. And I, you know, it would have been funny. It wouldn't have made sense in the movie if they focused in on it. But it would have been funny to see like these like radicals, like, you know, going up to politicians like at movie theaters in Brooklyn and like harassing, you know, doing whatever, the disrupting, you know, like doing seeing like politicians having to like paint them as like, oh, these crazy leftists over here.
How can you allow the Truman Show to continue?
Exactly. So I love that they included it. I like that you were talking about the media, because I feel like I was like more into that metaphor about mass media than I was about reality TV. They were, the way they were completely manufacturing his reality, and the way they did it through fear, I thought that was brilliant.
Yes.
Because yeah. They wanted him to stay, you know, the behavior they wanted out of him was him to not leave this island that is just a giant movie studio. So they were, showing him all these ads and stuff about how it's dangerous outside, like boating and sailing is dangerous. And when he was a kid, they instilled that fear on him by him being on a boating accident with his dad. And I was like, oh, this is his 9/11. Like that was his like incident. His 9/11 was being on a dangerous boat ride with his dad, killed his dad. And then so they use that constantly to instill fear in him and to propagandize him, which was brilliant.
Oh, it's such horrific manipulation once you realize what they have done to him. Like you're saying, like killing off his father. We find out like the actor who played his father is not actually dead. It was completely staged. But
oh yeah, just like the actors who played those hijackers, and just like that was, this was a joke.
yeah. Just,
I can see y'all faces. You're like, all right, we don't really know this guy that well. Yes, that was a joke.
Just in case
like,
there are any truthers listening, we are not actually going down that path.
I was like, yeah, just like in real life where we manufactured this thing. So
no, satire, comedy. But yeah, I love all those little touches of how they manipulate, and they're so subtle. Like one of the first things we see when he gets to work, when we first meet him, is his coworker with a newspaper article headline that says Sea Haven voted greatest place to live on Earth, which is just such a ridiculous fucking conceit.
Yeah.
I love the travel agency with all of the anti-travel propaganda on the wall.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even catch that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. When he goes into the travel agency to try to leave, there's just like posters of planes getting hit by lightning saying like it can happen to you. And
so funny. I mean, I caught that, but the irony that it's in a travel agency, I didn't catch that. That is hilarious.
But it has something to say about, you know, the way that media conditions people. It's a very like, it's a very, you know, manufacturing consent kind of manifested in like the most extreme way for this, you know, this satirical movie. But that it's not so far off from the way that media actually tries to spin, you know, the way that people think about certain things.
Right. The one of the first things that happens at the top of the film is a light falls down in the middle of the road, and it's a Sirius on it, which is actually, I think, like a Greek, the Sirius, the star. So there's some like really great prophetic screenwriting in there. But we know, I mean, we kind of see it and we recognize it as light. Truman's never, this wouldn't make sense to Truman's, the conditioned reality Truman's had his entire life. So but it's like that odd thing of like, this isn't right. And as soon as he gets into the car, the radio, because Christoph is controlling this world, starts to use the media to justify and make sense of what's happened. And it's just, and that continues to happen throughout the world, which I thought so brilliant, because they could just show us the media manipulating and propaganda and different ideas, but they show us the material thing happened, Truman having the experience of like, this is fucking weird, and then fast acting media, which we see all the time now, right? Which we're seeing constantly play out with how the media is trying to control.
Yeah, it's like Aaron Bushnell,
yes,
lighting himself on fire, which to the average American, like, should rattle them to the core, like, whoa, that's crazy. Yes. And the media immediately being like, well, he was crazy. Crazy guy, yep, doing crazy stuff. Who knows why this madman, this pyromaniac, would do this?
Exactly. And I think the hope is that we, as a society, can follow the Truman narrative, right? And eventually push back. And eventually, and I think it's happening, at least, right? I mean, you know, it is happening. That is the path of radicalization, when you start to be able to see clear enough how fucking bad this justification is, how you start to have those moments where, as in Truman's world, the radio station, you get like the wrong radio station, you're like, wait a minute, mm-hmm, that's not mm-hmm, the radio station they meant to play, like, they're,
or
just
like when it rains on him in Solo, like when yeah, it rains, yes, just on
exactly,
him, there's like a little bit of a read on the beginning of this movie with like the light falling, the rain, the radio, that, you know, could be read as a metaphor for radicalization. It's, you know, Truman starting to think more critically about his surroundings, because he's being confronted by the actual, you know, conditions of his world.
Oh, yeah. That was the very last scene before he's about to walk out through that door. He looks back. He thinks for a second, fleeting thought, like, wait, is Biden the lesser of two evils? And then he's like, no, I'm going to go ahead and open this door and walk out of here.
That's exactly it. Yeah. So prophetic. He even says it out loud.
He does.
It's 1998. And you're like, you're talking about Senator Joe Biden? What are we even talking about?
Yeah. Well, to follow along the lines that you're talking about, the path of radicalization for Truman, it's interesting. I love the character of Laura and the resistance movement in this film, which you touched on too, Joffer. There's clearly an organized resistance in this world, which I wanted to know a lot more about. But they do have some details, like when you... So Laura is the character who we first meet that Truman falls in love with, and she's wearing a red scarf. It's nice that I think the resistance has a lot of red surrounding them. She wears a red scarf. Like, there's this revolutionary spirit about them, because what I like about the way the film is structured too is we are introduced to the world and then it's pulled out, and we're introduced to like the bigger rules of the world within the world first, you know? So we actually get a chance to live in that world before we learn about how it's been made and Kristoff and all of the way it's organized, which I think is a really great storytelling device. And so when we learn about Laura, we find out she's part of this bigger movement that they have throughout Truman's life been able to sneak people on to set, trying to get the message to Truman that this is not the world as you know it. And I like that, because I think it's important that we understand that resistance is organized and it's not just one person. They could have said, okay, this is just Laura, but they do try and give us hints. You know, you see all over her walls that there's rallies, and in the world outside of the Truman Show, people, there is a group of people who are trying to free this human. So they have Free Truman posters, Whose Child Is Next, rallies. So there's an organized movement that finally gets Laura in. He sees her, he falls in love with her, and she tries to vocalize to him what's going on. And immediately, like we've been talking about, they send someone in. They send in a storyline to justify it and make her look crazy. And they pull her away. But he's still so hung up on this that he is trying to get to Fiji, where her father. But yeah, I thought what did you all think of the role of the resistance in this movie?
I think it's probably one of the most important parts of the movie, is showing that there is resistance. There is active resistance to what is slavery, like, for sure. Because it would have been very easy to not incorporate any of that into this storytelling, but it says so much about the ethical and moral questions set up in this movie, in this like insane premise that we're working within. So I think it's like incredibly important for Truman's development. And I it's just like a lovely sequence. And it's great storytelling, in that like we have this world, we have this fake constructed world, and we're going to show where the cracks are, and we're going to show like the threat to upend or destabilize Truman's world. And it's very fun. Like when they go through the little montage of how people have broke in, you know, in the past, it's like one guy like comes in via like a parachute. Like one guy springs out of one of his Christmas gifts when he's a child. So it's just like it does a bunch narratively, and it's just a fun storytelling device. I also realized on my second rewatch, because I rewatched it twice before this podcast, his last name is Burbank because that's where he is incorporated.
Wow. Mm. Damn.
Like Burbank, California.
The movie did such a good job of like having all these themes in there while still just being like a fun, good movie. Like all that resistance group stuff. Like if I would have written the movie, I would have made that shit like way too heavy handed. People would have like rolled their eyes and like, oh my God, what's the blah? But they, like, you know, they kept it. It's there. It's definitely there. Like you said, it shows what they were thinking when they were making this movie. Throughout, from the very beginning to the very end, it's just a great movie. Jim Carrey is so talented. I'm like, oh my God, I forgot how good Jim Carrey is.
Really is.
Excellent movie.
One other thing before we move on to Jim that I just realized about the resistance movement is it's also interesting how they end up having to keep Laura in the storyline. So they actually highlight the, because they have to, right? They highlight the fact that that Truman.
Well, because because he kept her sweater. He's like, he has a physical keepsake. So like, it's
right.
It's,
and
it's
so
now
I think what's interesting about that, exactly. And so they kind of have to monetize on it and make it work. And it's kind of, it's, I mean, this is a little reaching, but it's a little, but it's how in our media you'll see, oh, okay, we're going with Black Lives Matter. Let's monetize the fuck out of it. Let's go with Rainbow, like Rainbow Starbucks cups. It's like they kind of have to embrace the resistance and make it part of their storyline.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A little reaching, but
no, it's good. This is literally what this podcast is about, right? Is finding those little nuggets, which I think I agree with that. I also just really like, and this is more like cheesy, but you know, that was love. That was true love, you know, and that the manufactured relationship, even though everything in his world had told him that this is your wife, he never really felt that real thing. And he felt it for a fleeting moment one time, but it was enough for him to hold on to it, which I love that.
Yeah, that whole flashback sequence is also just like shot. It's like shot very dreamlike. It has a really soft and warm tone where a lot of the rest of the movie feels very like hermetically sealed, I think, intentionally. Mm-hmm. I also loved in the flashback how, and it really rang true to me because he's supposed to be college age in this flashback, that she keeps telling him that they don't want me talking to you. She says this to him multiple times. She's like, they don't want me talking to you. They don't want me talking to you. But instead of for a single second being like, wait, what are you talking about? He's like, I'm sorry, I'm horny. Can we just make out? Like, that's the only thing I'm thinking about right now.
Yeah.
Dude could have saved himself a lot of trouble if he had just listened for a moment.
I was going to say, like, I like how the manufactured America they created was the 1950s era of America. It's funny. It's the perfect era because it's the one we really look back on, or I mean, not us, but a lot of people look back on as like this sort of perfect era. But, you know, it was like, hey, TV was invented. We had toasters and also apartheid, but we don't, you know, we don't focus on that part.
Sure.
And so it was like the most whitewashed decade. And I thought it was perfect that they chose that to be like the aesthetic of where they were living.
Well, let's talk about Sea Haven, which is the name of the really like this giant soundstage that is Truman's world. They describe it as an entire human life recorded on an intricate network of hidden cameras broadcast live and unedited 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to an audience around the globe. It's one of only two man-made structures visible from space, this soundstage, Sea Haven Island. It has 5,000 cameras, and they describe it as Sea Haven, exactly like you're saying, is the way the world should be. And one interesting thing about where they shot this in Seaside, Florida. And the house that Truman lives in is actually the house that Matt Gaetz would grow up in.
Whoa. So,
did he grow up there? I read that the Gaetz family owned the house. Did we found out he in fact grew up there?
I read that he grew up there, but maybe they just owned it. Let's go with our lore that he grew up there because it makes sense. This is such a Make America Great Again location. Another fun thing about the world is there's no sunlight, clearly, because it's this soundstage. And so there are, Peter Weir does such an amazing job of building the details of the world, which is why I also think it's just such an amazing movie. He had, I think, a year because Carrie was signed onto it, but had to finish shooting Liar Liar. So he had a year to really get deep. And they got deep on, like, I think he wrote like a whole thing about the rules of the world. But it's fun that in different shots, you'll see there's vitamin D pills because no sunlight. Oh, so wow. In order to keep Truman whatever happens when you don't get sunlight, he's taking vitamin D pills. So I think it's really effective how much was thought through by the director and the writer on this world.
Yeah, yeah. That's amazing.
I was reading also that the original script, Andrew Nichols' original script, was a thriller, essentially. It was like a psychological thriller. And when Peter Weir, and he was, there were like a number of different directors who were going to direct at some point. I think it was like maybe Terry Gilliam was on the list and a few other people. And when Peter Weir came on, he was the one who said, no, we have to make this lighter. Like, this has to be at least presented as a comedy. Like, it should feel like a sitcom up until the point where it doesn't feel like a sitcom. And yeah, echoing what you're saying, Rivka, they researched surveillance techniques for a lot of the camera shots and camera angles. A really brilliant thing this movie does is pretty much every single shot up until the point where Truman's world breaks and we see Christoph and the control room for the first time, every single camera angle is either like something that could functionally have been made on the Truman Show, or is like literally a secret camera, like a button cam or something, like stuck onto the lapel of people that Truman is talking to.
Wow.
So like we're seeing
the show. His father's ring had a camera in it.
Yeah. So we are seeing the first half, two thirds of the movie as if it is like an episode of the Truman Show. And then only once we break into the control room, which is, again, on the second watch, I was like, damn, this movie is so fucking good and smart and well-written.
So good.
It's the scene on the bridge with Truman and Marlon when Truman is like really about to lose it. And he's like, I'm pretty sure my entire world is fake. You are my best friend in the world. You are the one person who, if this is not going to be a scam, like, you are going to convince me of that. And it's in that, like, most vulnerable conversation is when we cut to Christoph feeding Marlon the lines, which I think is, like, it's right the moment where Truman's reality is really falling apart when we actually get to see the other half of how this show is produced. It's a brilliant script.
It is. And it's I love that it was originally supposed to be an action movie, because it's really a testament to how unique of a movie this is, because I understand that impulse. Like, if it's not an action movie, what is it? Like, what are we watching then? You know, but they mm-hmm. pulled it off. It's such a uniquely structured movie. It just starts out, you're watching the, like you say, you're just watching the Truman Show, and things just start to slowly unravel for him. And I think, Rivka, you mentioned earlier as well, like the prophecy of like sort of the surveillance state that we're under now, because like those cameras and things, I was imagining you could do that now with just all the ring light, the ring cameras we have all over.
Sure.
I was reading recently that like spies, like CIA spies that like go around the world and stuff, that surveillance is making their jobs impossible because everywhere they go, they're being monitored. Everywhere, all the social media footprint we have, you know, all the ring cameras and everything. And now the motherfucking CIA is like, you know what? This surveillance stuff has gone too far.
Stop.
So I'm saying, you know, it's gone too far now when the goddamn
hilarious.
CIA is like, can you respect our privacy as international spies, please, so we can do our damn job?
Yeah, if the CIA ghouls are saying there's too much surveillance, then we have truly gone off the deep end. Yeah. That is incredible.
It's also, it's the surveillance and it's also the self-surveillance now. So this is a show, they're like introducing us to the world of like Truman not knowing. But you go on TikTok, you're like, there's TikTok live channels of people just doing their own Truman shows and trying to do it for monetary purposes. Like, this is, again, this goes back to this, you could, this all goes back to the capitalism of it all, right? So this whole show, the Truman Show, makes a gross revenue of a small country. It's like, and that is part of the way they justify, as you see capitalism being justified all the time. It's like, well, all the jobs it creates, all the things that it does. Like, so they keep justifying to when Kristoff talks about the show and is interviewed about it, just justifies this world, the Truman Show being run because of all the jobs it gives people. And also there's this other premise, which I think is really interesting, of like the false choice of capitalism. So Kristoff is really, and I think he truly believes it, which is why I think Ed Harris plays him really well. It's like a genuine belief in his role as the benevolent capitalist at the top of this all, is that he really is like, you know, if Truman wants, he can leave at any time. But the reality is he's been adopted by a corporation. You know, there's like, we know he can say that, but there's all the bigger legals. And the movie kind of, it lets us know that. And there's constant also moments along those lines where they give him the, you know, you could get on the boat anytime. But like you said, we've just scared the shit out of you. We know you're not going to because we have given you your own personal 9/11 or what, you know, you're so scared to get on this boat.
Yeah.
You can go, but the dog, but you're terrified of dogs.
They're also setting up fucking forest fires for him to have to drive through, nuclear reactor meltdowns. They're sending guys in hazmat suits chasing after his like his crazy ass. Like, they are not letting this guy leave.
Yeah,
but it's important that they are able to keep telling the audience and telling themselves that there's like freedom in this world, just like we're told there's freedom under capitalism. And there's not freedom in any other system. This is the most free system, when we know that's a false narrative. So I think this movie does that brilliantly.
You know what? I'm just thinking right now, like the sort of Truman shows we see in real life today. And I think the one that really is close to it, and it's like a guilty pleasure of mine because I love cute babies. I have baby fever. I don't want to have a kid ever, but I love cute babies in real life. And I have it's a guilty pleasure because like it's one thing where you just see like a video of like, oh, someone took like one video of a cute kid and it went viral. But there's like these channels, right? And it's like these parents who have their little adorable baby be like their TikTok or Instagram channel, and they have like millions of followers. And I'll watch those videos. I love those videos. But it's a bit of an ethical quandary, right? Because they are monetized. They're making a shitload of money off of their kid who, like Truman, has no idea. Like, I'm talking, you know, the babies, the toddlers. They really have no idea. They have all these fans around the world, and they are the cash cow, this little machine. And I wonder, like, what's that going to be like when they get old enough to start to realize what's going on? It just seems, it gives me the heebie-jeebies, these little viral sensation celebrity children, babies, because at
as
least,
it should.
Yeah, because at least like with child stars and movies, they eventually came with regulations and stuff to protect the kids and give them like some control over their finances. Very like, you know, not enough at all.
Pretty limited. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the child acting, I've been talking about it a little bit on stage recently. That's probably why this came into my head. So, I've been trying to do a bit about it on stage where I'm just like, isn't it crazy we have child actors? Like, isn't child labor wrong?
Yes.
But we just can't imagine a world without young Sheldon. Like, we can't let go of that. We need, I can't live without 2.5 men. You know, what would 2.5 men be without child labor? 2 men? That sucks. I don't want to watch that. That's the worst show in the world. But it's like the one exception we have towards like a 3-year-old doing labor. Like, there's no, except for our own entertainment purposes. And with the advent of social media, again, we're at ground zero, where before they had like some minimal protections. Now they have absolutely none again. It's their parents are the corporation now. And so, yeah, that's, I guess what I was saying is like the closest we could get to a real life Truman Show, like the baby, the 1-year-old Truman is pretty identical to the 1-year-old, 2-year-old TikTok star that we see today.
You're so right. And we're seeing it already really quickly. I mean, I don't know if you followed Ruby Frankie and the 8 Passengers. I'm a bit of a true crime.
What was that?
It was a Mormon mommy influencer they had one of these channels exactly like you're describing, where and this isn't the only one. You see this over and over, where it's monetized to put your family on camera 24/7. And again, intersecting with like Mormonism. There's like a lot of this in those families. They have a lot of kids and many different things. But she essentially is now going to jail, I believe, for child abuse, severe child abuse that was also happening. You know, there were signs. It's like one of those it's very Truman Show-esque in the sense that the audience was starting to say, like, this is not acceptable. Like, this is – it was this – people were, like, watching this happen, of course, until finally – and you're right. It's – I didn't even think about that. I'm like, it's super Truman Show-esque.
And if they did that version of the Truman Show, it would kind of be unwatchable, because at least when you're watching it, you obviously see Truman as this victim. You're fighting for him. But at least he was like a grown man. But like, imagine the Truman Show, but it's like a 6-year-old. And there's all these grown actors around him lying to. They don't even need to lie, really. That would be unwatchable. We'd be like, yo, this is fucked up. This is too dark.
That. No.
Well, you know what's interesting about that? And I hate to make this segue, but it's true. Is that the director, Peter Weir, described that the human he was sort of modeling this around when he was thinking of the character of Truman was Michael Jackson.
Oh,
interesting.
Damn.
Just someone who spent like their entire life in front of the camera. Yeah.
Someone robbed of their childhood.
And childlike in a way, which,
I like this question. I think, you know, the question of child acting, and Joffrey, I think you put it perfectly. Like, it's the only type of child labor that we're totally cool with, and I think that needs to be reinvestigated. I don't know, maybe, like, now that we're talking about it, like, maybe child actors is the one place where AI could be used, should be used. Like,
exactly.
If that's these kids are going to sit, I don't know, something.
That's where I'm trying to go with the bit.
And in terms of parents monetizing their children on social media, I don't know. I think that's personally fucked up. But at the same time, I know that there must be at least some section of those parents who, like, their material circumstances are such that they're like, we need fucking money. And, like, this is an avenue for us to get there. We have this adorable child. I am not condoning it. I had a buddy when I was living in L.A., you know, working class guy, had just gotten married, him and his wife having their first kid. Turns out they're having twins, and he's just like, oh, fuck, we're having twins. This is now twice the cost of everything. I saw, like, they were like, we're still excited, but we're super stressed. The kids came, had two adorable identical twin girls. They were out one day, casting director, it's LA, so a casting director at, like, the fucking cafe that they're at was like, hey, just so you know, you have twins. Twins are incredibly lucrative in the baby acting world, because if one of your kids, you know, goes over time, you got a spare. So, like, I'm telling you, and they're like, no, we really, really don't want to do it. We don't want to get involved in the kid acting world. And eventually they caved. And then, like, I saw him, like, 6 months later, and he was like, they've booked so many commercials that their college has paid for.
Wow.
So, like, I heard that, and I was like, that's amazing. That's amazing that you guys now have that financial security. It's very conflicting. It raises a lot of these ethical questions. But I do think that, like you're saying, Joffrey, we have one regulations, at least, like, in fucking Hollywood for child acting, as opposed to, you know, parents on social media.
And you're 100% correct to raise that point. Like, yeah, the systemic nature of people just trying to find an escape and some way to feel secure.
Wow, I almost got through an episode without bringing up the fact that I'm reading Capital. But there is, like, a whole, like, one of the, like, the big It's our new running segment. I just got through a big section where the description of the child labor, like, just that you're bringing this up, like, the child labor in these factories. Wild.
Oh, yeah.
Like, 8-year-olds.
Yeah.
I mean, it's coming back.
I mean,
it's coming back, baby.
It's coming back.
US of A. I was going to say, the one major difference in the Truman Show, as opposed to, like, all other kind of reality TV, but it's still what you were saying, Joffrey, like, watching a baby who was unaware, is that this is not just, like, the commodification of, like, someone's life. It's the commodification of the genuine human experience, or the so-called true human experience, and that Truman is unaware that he is on a show. And Christoph even says it, you know, like, that's what makes you so good to watch, is that you do not know that you are in a show. And Christoph keeps having this refrain that the world that he has created for Truman is more of a, the real world than the actual real world, because the real world that we live in has crime and it has people who lie and take advantage of you and all of the things that don't actually, in Christoph's mind, make a real life. And bringing it back again to their choice to set it in this sort of like 1950s idyllic looking white American town. I don't think there is a single person of color in this movie, and I think it feels very intentional. But this world that Christoph
there are the neighbors.
Oh, you're right. You're absolutely right. He has the
which
black
felt
neighbors.
even like very MAGA to me. Like the placement,
but they had the ideal percentage of minorities in their ideal world.
Good afternoon, good morning, and good night.
But this life that that Christoph has constructed for Truman is the world of a normal white middle class consumer. That is first and foremost what Truman is, and what Christoph wants Truman to be is the perfect consumer. Someone who does not walk away from their financial obligations or their societal expectations, like getting married and having kids, and someone who does not think critically about the system that they were born into. Because much of that laid in with like the ad reads and the way that like Laura Linney just keeps being the person that's like, hey, but like, what if we were just normal and you stopped thinking about all of this stuff? Like, what if you, like, they're the person in your life that's like, yo, you guys are thinking about politics a little bit too much. It's getting a little intense.
And you're right. Like, the 1950s was, right? Like, that was like the birth of like modern consumerism that we understand it today, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's modernism. It's like, well, we've arrived at, you know, we're post-war. The only thing we have to worry about as America is just like buying some fun gadgets and, you know, making some cold lemonade for your fellow when he gets home or whatever.
Exactly.
To riff on the consumerism a bit, and you kind of brought this up at the top, Joffer, like the TikTok, like now it's, that really worked in the 1950s world, but when we see it now, it's still very similar, just it morphs into using the language of like the time. So I'll be on TikTok, and I feel like this is even rather new. I didn't notice it, at least until like a few months ago. But you'll go in the comments of like a random video that you think like, this is just, to your point, Frank, about being like kind of like human, just like a goodness. Like someone just found a bug on the floor doing a cute thing and they're recording it. And this is a good, sweet moment. And this is why social media can sometimes be lovely. And you go to the comments and it's like Walmart commenting or like Kellogg's commenting, rolling in that dirty, dirty gel, like something totally nonsensical, like a nonsensical, like trying to imitate the voice of Gen Z, I perceive.
This video of this parrot being friends with this dog was brought to you by Glade Plugins.
Oh, wow. Thank you.
Yeah.
Glade.
But they don't even have to say brought to you anymore. They'll like, they manipulate the idea of being like the actors in this show. They sort of act as if they're also... like, we're not brands, we're humans. We're your favorite and your newest Gen Z commentator. Like, it's really creeped me the fuck out.
I have so many comedy friends who have gotten jobs, like, they would write for, like, Glade Plugins Twitter account, you know? So they can be, like, witty and charming and fun online, but they're basically being a person as a brand.
Okay, this makes me think of, this was something that I was super interested in this rewatch of the movie, was the role of the arts worker. So like you're talking about your comedy friends, like the role of the arts worker under capitalism and what this movie tells us about it, what it starts to explore. So we have this, like, one of my favorite things, because I love a meta universe, is the fact that there are actors outside, right, who get hired for this movie to play actors who are playing characters in the world. So you have Laura Linney playing an actress who's playing Meryl. And I just thought that, like, I love the glimpses we would get of the laborers, right? Like that, the island of labor that this show is, the small population that this show is employing. But like, these are pretty much arts workers, right? So you have like the behind the scenes, the actors, and we'll get glimpses of it, of like how much they're actually like working very, very hard, laboring to like manipulate Truman's reality. But you get to see the sweat labor of that, which I appreciate. Like once the scenes, like there's the scene where he goes into the elevator and they were there in time, and you see them like like rushing to get into hair and makeup. And then you, as Truman's journey into this world sort of appearing to him, we also start to get more of a glimpse of that world when he goes to the travel agent and she obviously had to rush there because he's like getting off script and she still has her makeup bib on. So these things are revealing themselves to us, and I'm really interested in...
Oh, I didn't catch that.
And there's lots of little stuff, things like that. I think the person we probably follow the most is Meryl, because she is the one who comes the closest to just breaking when she's like, when Truman's going after her, like shaking her to tell him what's going on, and she's screaming like, this is unprofessional. She's basically screaming out for help to her limit without breaking the reality. You know, one of my favorite quotes is Tony Cade Bambaro, that the role of the artist is to make the revolution irresistible. And this film sort of shows us that the role of the artist under capitalism is to control and justify the capitalistic worldview. And I think as we follow these actors, like, I'm interested in the laborer who's like that class of actor who's stuck there, right? When we don't have a, they don't have a choice. This is how they're employed. Peter Weir, again, had so much time to world build. Apparently, he sat with like Laura Linney and the other, I can't remember the other actors' names right now, but the one who played the best friend and
Noah Emmerich
and Holland Taylor, who played the mom.
Yes, Holland Taylor.
And they all went so deep into the backstory of their characters that they even made a mockumentary. Because he was like thinking of different ways. They made a mockumentary of the actors who were on The Truman Show. And here's just like a taste. Here's something that Peter Weir's said in a interview with Spliced Wire about the ad-libs, and that the interview that she shot as the actress, this is Laura Linney, as Hannah Gill, is incredible. She is so cold and so hard and so neurotic because of what she's done. She's immensely wealthy, making profits of a Merrill-made line of clothing and so forth. But she's so deeply compromised because of all this. She signed a contract not only to sleep with Truman, so it's like super whoredom, but she also likes to think of it as an arranged marriage, but also the fact that she's trying to conceive a child. And if she does, certain kickers will come into contract. Also, there's a whole contract over the rights to the child when it's born. Like,
oh my God. Oof. Wow. Jesus.
That's amazing.
That's amazing.
And so Laura Linney had all of this. I'll also add that the best friend character, I couldn't find the exact quote, but I know that his backstory, he created this whole thing about also being, he grew up as a child actor on the show as the best friend, and how much that wore down on him, and that he developed alcoholism, but also is always carrying around those beer. Like, I thought it was just really amazing and admirable, again, the world that the actors working on this movie created for their actors who are laborers on this show, and what it tells us about like the paradox of being any kind of labor under capitalism. I know it's particularly for artists, how hard it is to want to do what we want to do and also have to make a living under capitalism. And just like you were saying about your friends who are comedians, or, you know, I felt this before auditioning for maybe shows that I don't share values with, or you know, commercials that you're like, I don't believe in what this product is doing or want to be involved with it, but what choice do I have? I also want to eat. And like,
yes, I feel like artists, we get like a little extra, a little more under the microscope than normal people. No, I don't want to say normal people, but like people with like regular jobs, instead of going for their dream job, which is like, you know, trying to be an artist. Your regular day job, you're going to probably be working for some terrible, under some terrible parent corporation that's doing horrific, terrible stuff. But like being an artist who's like, oh, I can do a little bit of comedy writing for money, but it's for like this brand or whatever. To me, it's like, it's the same thing. It's the same as, you know, working retail for another company. It all sucks, but it's all kind of, you know, what we have to do sometimes.
Yeah, it's that there is no ethical consumption. But that's, I think it's everyone's decision where their personal line is, whether they're...
Exactly. Because it is a spectrum.
It's definitely a spectrum. Yeah. And you even got to go back to, like, are you even going to acknowledge that there is a line to begin with? That's, like, step one. Because some people are like, this isn't even a choice. What are you talking about? Obviously, I'm going to go work for Raytheon.
Right. And the fact that Laura Linney had Meryl, like, capitalizing on her role in the show and making her own brand of clothing, and that makes sense.
Man,
I can
that is
see
incredible.
That.
Just me and my girlfriend, just after watching, we both loved it, and we kind of came up with our own lore around these actors, because that was a big thing we were talking about, is like how much money would be worth it to play a guy's wife every day and night of your life. Like, is there any amount of money that would, like, when do you get to enjoy your life? And And we were also just, again, just imagining, like, adding lore to the movie of just like, yeah, I'm sure they must have signed some like very like exploitive contracts early, and there were probably like starving artists, and now they're trapped as well. And it, they show in the, like you were talking about in the movie, they beautifully show like the crack of these actors who have to be around Truman for years.
And that's really interesting, especially with Marlon, the best friend character, because he's the other person in the world other than Truman that has been there from ostensibly like he was a child. So he was unwillingly cast as a child actor into this role. So this raises, that's honestly maybe the worst gig, even worse than being Truman, is being Marlon, because he's been indentured his entire life, but he completely knows that it is all bullshit. Like, oh, yeah. Every
single...
He doesn't
get the ignorance is bliss thing. He knows.
Exactly. This movie also made me think of the Society of the Spectacle. Yeah, I read it a few years ago, and I'll be honest, it's one of those books. It's a philosophy book. It was written in 1967 by Guy Debord, who was a Marxist philosopher. And it's one of those books that, like, at least for me, I read it and I was like, okay, I'm pretty sure I got that. But like the general gist of it is it's about the commodification of the social experience, which is what he dubs the spectacle. And he, again, this was written in 67, and he was writing about this idea that there is barely any, if not any, true human experience anymore. And that for every single aspect of human experience has either been commodified or is being performed or presented in a way that is quote unquote spectacle. So a couple of like things in the book, he said, all that once was directly lived has become mere representation. It is the decline of being into having and having into merely appearing. The spectacle is not a collection of images. Rather, it is a social relationship between people that is mediated by images. And this
damn,
was...
Why do Marxist philosophers gotta be such bummers, dude? Yeah, damn.
It's almost like they're calling it as they see it. But I remember I first read Society of the Spectacle a few years ago, I think when like Instagram really hit. And I remember someone saying to me like, oh, this is the Society of the Spectacle. It's like everyone is presenting this version of themselves, this like this false or even commodified version of themselves is which, like what we want to be appearing as opposed to like what an actual true human experience is. So I just wanted to bring up Society of the Spectacle, because if I didn't, we would 100% get an angry email from a listener who said, you guys are fucking dog shit. Because you didn't mention the one thing that I wanted to hear spoken about.
You gotta love your fans, all of our, gotta love audiences.
No, we do. We love them. Thank you guys so much.
Yeah, of course. I love that aspect of Truman Show as well. And I think the parts that really hold up are that are like spectacle, meaning like the audience. Like it's all people who are craving authenticity and all people who are selling authenticity, and it's never quite there.
Well, one could argue that's interesting because what you said, like finding the Truman of today, and I don't know if you followed any of Risa Tisa on TikTok, or if anyone, the people who know what I'm talking about. It was the Who the Fuck Did I Marry series.
I still haven't seen this, but you explained it to me, so I understand the cultural context.
I did explain it to Frank.
Was it that lady was like a 60-part?
Yes.
A 60-part yes. TikTok?
Yes.
Okay, explain it to me, because I just saw one. I didn't understand what I was seeing.
So this, yeah, because this series blew up over TikTok, and I think it started in a genuine... This woman, Risa Tisa, went through this horrific experience with a man who was a serial liar and just put her through the ringer, very relatable, sat down with her camera, said, I'm going to tell you this story. I'm going to tell you in detail, in parts, just like no fast cuts, like long form storytelling, like you're sitting around a fire. Part one, Who the Fuck Did I Marry? I'm like, okay, people are talking about it. I'm like, we'll see. My attention span generally, especially if I'm anywhere near TikTok, is fucked, right? So my finger is already swiping before I have any control, full addiction, like terrifying.
Do you do the fast scroll?
It's terrifying. There's like, thank God, like I have to engage in other forms, because the reality of the addiction of the thing is horrifying.
Yeah, dude. I used to get proud of myself reading books. Now I'm proud, like, watching an episode of something without checking my TikTok. Anyway, sorry. Yeah, I'll stop petting you off.
No. It's true. And what I loved about this series, and maybe it was the Truman component in a world of so many fast cuts and what's becoming more fake realism, like it's just more and more people trying to like replicate authenticity and realism. This was just so a friend sitting down at a fireplace like we've done for ages, telling you this detailed, in-depth story, 60 parts of who the fuck did I marry? And you're getting, the comments are saying like, and it's true, I didn't scroll through my page, my For You page, didn't touch it for days. And everyone stopped and like got on this and it blew up. And then the monetization came. And then it was just this expected like, okay, now Netflix comes. Now it's like we have this really like this moment of like a sacred, truly like authentic, ooh, joyful, yeah, Truman-esque storytelling, and you just felt it, and it was like then, and that was what I mentioned, like suddenly you had to be there for the first few hours before the vultures of capitalism came, and they came, and then there's part of you that's also happy, she's like, you know, because part of the struggle was like real working class struggle of like not being able to get a car, this guy promising to get her a car, wanting to go to Europe, and like now she's getting all those things. But it is like, it feels so Truman Show of like, you had to be there. You had like 2 like days to get the authentic, true sitting around the fireplace before the camera crew. And like, you know, she's in the cut. And if you're just finding out about it, I'm sorry, you're going to have to watch it through the lens of capitalism now, because it was a 2-day authentic event.
No, that's perfect.
Yeah.
It reminds me of, I can't believe I forgot this. Me and my girlfriend were talking about this watching, remember Jury Duty, that show that came out?
Amazon. Oh, wow. I can't believe we haven't talked about this yet.
Yeah, which we love. So I enjoy Jury Duty.
Jury Duty.
So yeah, so if you don't know the premise, it's like this guy, he thinks he's in regular jury duty, but everyone is an actor. He thinks they're filming it, doesn't realize they're all actors. I like the way they did it because they picked a nice guy and they made him the hero. And so while, like, you know, he didn't know what was going on and they were being disingenuous with him, at least it's like, okay, well, they weren't like dunking on him. They were celebrating.
It was good natured. The show was all good natured.
Yes. But what was interesting is like, so all of a sudden this guy's famous now and he's beloved, right? So now he is a famous guy. And, you know, me and my girlfriend both fell in love with this guy. And so we follow him on Instagram. But now on Instagram, he's just exclusively brand stuff. So he is now just his job now is to be an ad. He is a walking, talking ad. And it was like, yeah, this guy, we all love him because he didn't ask for any of this. We love him because he was truly authentic on television. And when he's done with that, the rest of his existence is going to be an ad because he was this authentic guy.
Damn.
Wow. I'm so glad you brought that up.
A fucking bummer.
Yeah. Of course, watching, even as you were saying that, and I'm like watching us be like, yeah, but it was good natured. Like, no, like.
It was.
I know it was, but like, honestly, like, are we not being the Truman Show audience? Like, they all thought that was good natured.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh my God.
100%.
Like, I'm with you. I want to protect that shit too. But like, if we're really going to really be fucking critical, like, it's fucked up. None of it was good natured. They lied to him. Like, if we're straight up about it, and I'm not,
right? It was disingenuous.
I'm not willing to let go of Jury Duty, but they did gaslight a human being. Like, even though he's like in on the, like, that fucks, we were all down to fuck someone up psychologically for our entertainment. And I'm not saying I'm above it because I love that show. I'm just pointing out, like, you got me a little fucked up because I'm like, we are that Truman Show audience. And they show the way they cut away to the audience, you do feel like none of those people feel like they're, you know, they're not like screaming at the TV. They feel like he's part of their world. They literally have the countdown of days. Like, their own world is like in some ways tracked by his life.
Oh, yeah.
Because they like count the days down, and like there's a guy sitting in a tub with him. He's like, if he goes away, again, it goes back to that contract we have as an audience and why it's so hard to imagine the end of capitalism, because we are also so deeply in contract. Like, if it's this hard to even just admit how fucked up Jury Duty is. And I find it like heartbreaking to be like, yeah, no, it's, let's find all the excuses to make, have another.
I love Jury Duty. I loved it so much. But he really, like, okay, his post life now, he's rich. So I think, like, with like the world we live in, that is huge. That is undeniable. And you can, you know, have, we all have our different analyses of that depending on our politics, but he that's kind of the trade-off. Like, okay, he was lied to, but now, like, what was his job?
I don't know
before?
The numbers. I don't know the numbers, yeah. Joffer, but I beg to guess that there's someone, he may be rich, but there's someone who's richer off of his existence. You know, there's like a Kristoff, and like there's people who are like richer, and he's still like, I don't know. Yeah. Can money buy how psychological? Like, if that actually happened to me, I would be happy to be. There'd be a part of me to be like, just like the part of me that's like, I don't care about the labor laws. I wish I was a child actor. Are you kidding me? Like, there's like a part of me that's like, yeah, take me and make me famous, whatever.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, who gives a shit? He's rich. He doesn't have to work anymore. Like, that's me. Every time anything bad happens to a rich person, I'm like, who gives a fuck? Fuck them. Then, you know, I don't mean that, but part of, you know what I mean? Like, you understand.
Can he trust anyone? Like, can he trust anyone again in his life? And is that worth it? Like, you go through an experience like that. Do you think you can ever really fucking trust
exactly,
anyone?
Dude. You got to go to therapy after that shit. This would be the sequel of the Truman Show. Would be like Truman. Okay, he walks out of the thing. Now he's a normal person, but he's also like one of the most famous, beloved guy. Honestly, he'll never get to be a normal person. Now he walks into the normal life as a walking celebrity, and is probably being asked to do like all these brand deals and appear on talk shows and stuff. So now that's his life. Another fake life, essentially.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I hadn't even considered that. You're absolutely right. His life
after this is the jury duty guy.
Yeah. No, but Truman in this movie, you're right. He doesn't walk out and just like go have a normal life. He's one of the most famous people on planet Earth.
Damn. They really could do a sequel.
And we can't even name the jury duty guy's name. Like, I can't. I'm just saying that's how like he will forever be the jury duty. Like, Truman will forever be like the Truman Show guy. It totally strips you of your, like, humanity.
Yeah. I mean, could you imagine if the jury duty guy is beloved because he was nice guy. Oh, we saw an authentic person, and he was nice. He wasn't a fucking monster who disappoints us, like every person we're a fan of. So because of that, like, he can never come out and just have an opinion, right? No matter what the opinion was, he would lose that about him. And then his, like, career, whatever it is that he has in that, would completely vanish because he's like this authentic person, but he's also not like, he can't really be that real, or else he'll stop being the authentic nice guy, which is what we really love about him.
Inoffensive is what people are looking for. They just want someone to make them feel good, but not make them think too much, you know, because that's sad, and I don't like it. Really fast before we go to the awards, because we touched on it briefly, but I just want to talk about Jim Carrey for a second and just give that man his flowers. And look, I don't know everything. Like, I don't know everything about Jim Carrey. I'm sure he's done some problematic shit. I don't fucking know.
Who hasn't?
But pure admission, I was raised on Jim Carrey. That guy was my guy. Like, I was a child when Dumb and Dumber and The Mask and all of those movies came out. And then here's when we're getting into like his like I'm a serious actor era, and I just gotta say he's fucking beautiful in this movie. There's like maybe a couple moments like in the car when he's driving Meryl around that he's a little over the top. He's doing a little too much of the Jim Carrey like noises and faces things, but other than that, like I think it's a really controlled, revelatory performance in that we're watching this man realize that his entire reality is fake, and it's really beautiful. Like the scene where he first realizes that things are weird, and he starts just like touching the people in his town, and is just like exploring, and he's just like a child playing in this new world. And his whole final sequence of him getting off of the boat, I think, is probably some of the most beautiful acting he's ever done. And I love Peter Weir's choice in that moment to, just in the blocking of that moment when he reaches the wall of the studio, that Truman turns away from the camera and has his whole like giant emotional catharsis, like literally hunched over and his face not visible to the camera. It's like one of the first, biggest, purest emotional moments, and one of the truest moments of his life at this point. And Peter Weir is choosing to not give that to the audience and be like, you've watched this guy since he was literally a fetus. You don't get to see him like find his liberation in this moment. It's beautiful. And I love Jim Carrey, and I thought he was really good. That's it. Rant over.
I agree. I love Jim Carrey, and I loved him in this movie as well.
I know this is going long, but we knew it would because it's such a fucking good movie. And I can't believe I almost forgot to mention that when we were given the assignment to watch The Truman Show, I took it upon myself. I said, you know what I'm actually going to do immediately is listen to Jim Carrey's semi-autobiography / fiction called Memoirs and Misinformation, a novel written by Jim Carrey and Dana Vachon, narrated by Jeff Daniels. And I have to tell you both, like, it slaps.
Narrated by Jeff Daniels. Wow.
Harry reading for Lloyd.
No, yeah. I am telling you, if you are fans of this Truman, of the Truman Show, you have to listen to this and listen to it because Jeff Daniels is amazing. And it's also just so good. And it's so like an extension of the Truman Show because it, like, first of all, the cover is his face and it's an actual picture that, I'm sorry, this is going to go a little deep, but you're going to want to hear this. This is so fucking Truman Show too. Like, this is wild. Okay. Remember when in Hawaii they had the fake warning that the nuclear missile warning went off?
Oh,
well,
yeah,
one,
yeah.
Jim Carrey was there. And damn. One Jim Carrey is living his Truman Show version of, like, this is really happening. I'm really, just like all of everyone was, I'm really about to die. And he, like, called his, I guess as you would, his assistant or something. And, like, they were FaceTiming. And she took a photo of him, like, in this moment when he thought he was about to die. And he talks about having this whole spiritual moment of kind of coming to terms and peace with whatever. The screenshot of him in this moment is the cover of his book, Memoirs and Misinformation. Okay, that's Truman Show number one. And Truman Show number two is just this whole thing is like, it's half, like, some of the stuff is real. So it does follow Jim Carrey and it is his life as like a celebrity. But then there's things that are just totally made up. Like, there's a whole made up character that's like a survivor contestant that he dates. But apparently that's not real. But then there are things that are real. And it's like all these celebrities are in it. It's so good. It's so good.
That's interesting to hear because I have seen some like recent Jim Carrey interviews. And he is very much on like he is trying to reach nirvana. And like I mean that in like the true Buddhist sense where he is like, I am just a consciousness that is inhabiting this skin suit at this moment. And then this skin suit will die. And I like these are things that like I've heard Jim Carrey say. He is thinking about consciousness and experience and performance and, you know, and reality itself. So, like it's not surprising that the guy who went from playing Truman to fucking Andy Kaufman is now, like, this guy who was like, we're not even real. Like, I'm not real, you're not real.
Yes. Yeah.
What would lead this guy to believe this?
Totally. Fascinating. All right. So, we've made it, finally, to our awards. And we're going to give some. Joffer, the first award that we give to this movie is Best Politics. This goes to the character with the best politics in the movie.
I think it's probably got to be Laura / Sylvia, yeah, the woman. Yeah.
Right.
That, yeah, 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 because she's part of the Free Truman movement. A lifelong Truman abolitionist, you know, came onto the set to try to help Truman. Yeah, she's probably got the best politics.
I think it's clear. And, like, then there's the worst politics. Got to be Kristoff.
Got to be
right?
Kristoff.
Got to be Kristoff.
Yeah. I think so. Even the network executive who should be the more bloodless capitalist is like, you're going to fucking kill this guy. Like, stop storming on him. But Kristoff is the one that, yeah, planned this whole thing, has this whole straight up a god complex. I think one of the hardest laughs that I had in this rewatch was when he speaks to Truman for the first time and Truman's like, who are you? And Ed Harris's line delivery is, I am the creator of a television show. It's just very good.
I mean, fucking get over yourself.
And friggin' Kristoff too, like how he values, it's just such a great evil capitalist. Like, he values his privacy deeply and they make sure to let you know. So, like, he's exploiting every moment of this person, but he, like, he loves his privacy. Like, Kristoff wouldn't dare be, you know.
I also loved when they were taking calls from the audience and it was The Hague for Kristoff. It's a great joke.
Oh, damn. That's
good. Yeah. That's just good shit. All right, and our last award is Best Supporting Character / Spinoff. So this goes to your favorite supporting character and maybe a spinoff you would see them in. I would watch more of we talked a little bit about it, the Free Truman movement. Mm-hmm. I would watch like a whole movie from their perspective, like from like the inception of it. Because like ostensibly the Truman Show starts in the early 70s. or the late 60s, since he's about to turn 30. So this is like right at the tail end of like the radical 60s. So I don't know, maybe it's like some of like the students from Democratic Society, some of like the leftover from the New Left form the Free Truman movement.
I love if they made the mockumentary about the wife, because I would like to see that. Yeah, seeing Truman as a celebrity, it is post-Truman world and still kind of being a Truman would be interesting to me as well.
Totally. I guess I thought Paul Giamatti's character was really interesting as well. Yeah. So like the people working on the show right under Christoph, but also the stress of being, the world of the laborers who are keeping this machine moving, and how that affects their at-home life and the guilt of that.
Like an IATSE union member meeting where they're talking about the Truman Show, and they're like, guys, a lot of the rank and file is starting to feel weird about this whole Truman Show thing. And then the other half is like, those are our jobs. You're trying to get rid of our jobs. Joffer, this was awesome. I thank you for staying. I know we went long. I really appreciate it. We had some technical issues. You were a champ, but this was such a great movie, such a great conversation. So thank you.
Thank you all.
Yeah. The last thing we like to do is ask our guest how we as artists and people strive to practice our values in our own lives, whether they be anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist, leftist, whatever. So is there one thing that you do in your day-to-day life where you get the chance to practice your values? And it could be anything from like a practice that you engage in to an organization you work with.
I've been going to rallies for Palestine, trying to call, do the Five Calls app. That feels useless. I mean, it all kind of feels useless, but I guess it's better than not doing anything. And trying to, you know, make whatever videos I can make about it, talk to people about it, argue with people about it, be annoying about it online. You know, I know a bunch of people have unfollowed me, but really that has been sort of occupying my mental space lately.
Thank you for sharing that. And where can our audience find you?
TikTok, Instagram, Joffer Khan. I think my handles are Joffer Khan Comic. And if you live in New York, I do a lot of stand-up, so you can come out to a show.
I will definitely come catch you in a show sometime soon. So
please do.
Yeah, love to. Joffer, thank you again. This was awesome. It was great meeting you.
Yeah, sorry I got to run, but I really appreciate y'all having me. I had a very great time. I think this
was
great.
You.
So thanks again.
Thank you all so much for listening, and make sure to follow us on Instagram and TikTok. And if you want to support the show and get access to our premium episodes, you can do so by going to mvcpod.com to subscribe to our Patreon.
For next week's movie, we will be watching the 1998 Robert Zemeckis live-action animation hybrid feature film, Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Thank you, everyone.
Bye.